Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Logenplatz, der Filmpodcast mit Stefan Kuhlmann.
Herzlich willkommen zu diesem Logenplatz-Spezial. Es geht um Slow Horses. Die zweite Staffel ist da, endlich. Und ich kann es schon verraten, die dritte und die vierte Staffel sind auch schon greenlit, wie man so schön sagt. Renewed, wie man gerne sagt. Und ich freue mich wahnsinnig über diese Spezialausgabe. Wir sind hier in den neuen heiligen Hallen von Apple Music. Das ist einfach im Soho-Haus, Leute. Ihr könnt es euch nicht vorstellen. Die haben ja innerhalb der, weiß ich nicht, letzten zwei Wochen gefühlt hier mein Studio hingestellt. Das ist der absolute Wahnsinn. Aber der absolute Wahnsinn, sehr viel mehr, ist eben unser Logenplatz-Spezial mit Saskia Reeves und Dustin Demery Burns. Okay, ich mache das jetzt weiter auf Englisch, Leute. Ihr könnt Englisch. Das könnt ihr doch, oder? Ja, könnt ihr. Dankeschön. Recap. A boss that hates your guts and insults you. Staged kidnapping, bomb threat, secret emails, the sons of Albion, Larry Curly Moe, Zippo, Taverner, false suicides, betrayal, double crossing, and all that jazz. All that stuff that makes A for an intriguing plot, an intriguing show, and B, brilliant, absolute brilliant television. It's all there in season one, and hooray, there's even more in season two without giving too much away. New spies, new threats, same old Jackson Lamb. Russian sleeper agents, higher stakes, more drama, more dark humor. Seasons three and four are greenlit.
Yeah.
Yeah, by Apple. Yeah, thank you guys. It's a fantastic show. I love season one and two, and I'm very happy and thankful you guys found the time to talk to me. Cheers. So, welcome,
thank
Saskia
you.
Reeves.
Thank you.
And Dustin Demery Burns.
Thank you. Danke.
Should I ask? This is something that we do, we Germans, right? Do you speak any German? What do you speak?
No,
that's it. Danke.
Danke. And alles klar.
Alles klar, so very good point.
No German. I did German O level, but didn't do very well.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
And my mother is Dutch. I don't speak Dutch either, so.
Well, the thing is that with English, you can assume throughout the world that people might speak it.
It's a that was the argument my mother gave.
Yeah.
What's the point of teaching Dutch? No one speaks Dutch. And I said to her recently, Mother, if I'd spoken Dutch, I could be working in Holland now. There's a fantastic theatre director who's just set up a company in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I could be in that company.
You could be in that company. It's never too late.
Yeah. Yeah, or you could also go to Pennsylvania.
Why?
The Pennsylvania Dutch.
Oh.
Okay, so
that won't
be in the next one.
No.
For those who haven't seen season two, and it starts this Friday, it starts on the second, where your characters, Catherine and Min, now literally and physically, in what place are your characters when we start the show, the second season? Saskia?
No.
You were looking at it.
No. Min's moved on. Somewhat in his relationship with Louisa, I think we're allowed to say that, and he's having a nice run. They're kind of becoming an item, and life is good. He's still at Slough House, so she, and so that's not so good. But I think Min can sort of turn a blind eye to that. He's sort of accepting his lot. He's got a bit of a spring in his step. They've also achieved some good things at the end of series one, and that should make them proud, but there's no sign of being taken back to, you know, Park House. So he's enjoying his life with Louisa, yeah, and it's given him a sort of newfound lease of life and confidence, and it's nice to see. But yeah, the job is still sifting through receipts and rifling through bins and, you know, taking laundry to the dry cleaners.
The good life.
The good life.
The good life.
Catherine, she's still missing her boss, her previous boss, very much. She's dedicated to doing this job, regardless of how grim it is. And she, I think, in this one, she really wants to be useful.
Mm.
And I've imagined the longer her sobriety continues, the more she needs to do something, and the more aware she is that she is very much sidelined and ignored. And I think she's coming to the point where she's like, no, actually, I can be of use.
What I find with the series is that the you have season one and season two, and it's like it feels the same, but it's all different. And this is what makes a good show, that you have, you know, you're not changing from CG animation to stop motion, but you know, you stay in the same realm. So I can't, you know, I think I know movies and you know, film and TV shows, but I can't really pinpoint what's the biggest difference in staying the same in this show. What's the trick behind there?
Well, they're all based, all the scripts, the series, as they call them, are based on the books. And so Mick Herron, who wrote the books, he's created this story, but you can actually pick up each book on its own. You don't have to read book one and two and three before you read, say, book four and five. Mm. And I think they've tried very hard to keep that in these series. And so series two, as opposed to series one, we're in the summer. For instance, we've got a different director for all six. We're not in the office as much. There's a lot of stuff goes on outside of the office. You see different parts of London. So there are elements that are incredibly different, but what we get is the chance to get to know these characters even more. And they have history, and they have backstory, they have families, they have relationships. So there's much more to find out about them, and I think that's what's proving to be successful actually, in the way they're being created.
So all these questions are basically for the both of you. So, you know, if it's feel free to say this. I can't be asked to answer that.
Okay.
But I always wonder, do you remember...
That's a good answer, that.
I can't be asked.
Well,
where's my coffee?
Where's my tea?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good studio, but the catering is shit. It's
bells and whistles.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always wondering, do you remember when you're... I call it the click moment, when you understood your character, when you knew who she or he is, and you knew how to portray them. Was that something that you found out when you read it the first time, or there could have been a moment on set where you stood there and you do a turn, and then you just go like, oh yeah, I got them.
That's an interesting
question,
isn't it? That's a really good. I'm not sure. I'm trying to. It's a very good question, but it's really making me think.
Now.
Sorry about that.
Why? Because you need your coffee.
No, because of that question. Actors have click moments. I don't have click moments.
It's tricky, yeah. I don't think it's sort of like, I think you sometimes find a flow, don't you? Mm-hmm. And you might kind of just be really enjoying that scene or that exchange, and maybe you're not questioning it much, and it's happening naturally, hence the flow. And maybe that is the click moment without being really conscious of the click moment. It's almost like you're unconscious of what you're doing, so you're just enjoying it.
Yeah.
But that said, I think my journey with Min.
Sounds come with, like a movie. Journey. My journey with Min.
My journey with Min. Sounds quite like a twee film. I'm not sure if I like this film. And I auditioned, and you get the sides, but you're not really aware of the bigger picture. We didn't know the books, I didn't get the whole script. You only get the sides, you know, just your scene. But immediately I think I kind of got an energy from him, and I sort of understood this slightly washed up kind of, you know, full of kind of regret and sort of in a sort of low point in his life. And so you immediately get those sort of clicks. And something clicked because I got the role. But then getting the bigger picture and reading the first book, just to get the context. I don't know if it ever really kind of, it made sense, and it was just a gradual sort of progression of like getting to know the character. But like I say, I think certain scenes on certain days, you just start really finding and getting into the skin of the character.
I know I'm German, but I'm not telling you to have a click moment. Yeah?
No, I know, but you've interviewed lots of actors and directors, so I'm thinking maybe they've all talked about this.
Yeah.
It came up. Like
The thing about I found working on film, whether it's TV or film, you know, with a camera and a director and an editor, you can, you're relying also on them seeing what you're seeing. You're relying on the communication between you being, you're on the same page. So mm-hmm. you in a bad situation, you can work and work and create a character, and then you see the edit and it's like, well, where's that? Why is my character like that? You know, because they can cut around you. So when all the things I think about my character, and I love playing her because I love physically inhabiting her, because I really think she has a body language that's very different to mine, and I really enjoy that. And it's down to the type of shoes that I'm wearing. Sometimes you get influence from external things. I do anyway.
Mm.
But if the
director... I do too.
If the director and you aren't talking on the same page, you know, they need to look after some of that and put it...
Mm.
They need to cut to blah, 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 you know.
Mm.
If you see what I mean. So Mick describes Catherine in the books as being almost OCD. She's very organised, very neat. And I love that about her. I love the fact that, you know, she can... She'll line up her files.
Yeah.
And her desk is very organized.
Because this is something you can grab on when you
Well, it's fun to pretend to be that person.
Mm.
Yeah.
Physically inhabit that person. So I'd go to a file of facts and I'd do it a certain way. Catherine won't. She's very organized. Now, if you don't focus that, if you don't use a tiny little bit of that in your cut or scene, if you're putting together Catherine on her own in the office, you're going to miss that detail.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, I don't want to show that. So I'll be enjoying my props and doing all that, and then...
But do you think even if, say, when they've filmed it, they've done the scene, you've done these details and you've watched the cut and it's not in it, but do you think the fact that you, in the moment, were there in that place, whether they've got the detail of you filing or not, the fact that you found that click is portrayed and it carries across anyway? Do you know what I mean?
One hopes so,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, our teas are out.
Tea's here, coffee's here.
Thank you very much.
To warm me up a bit.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that you, when you mentioned that, is that because my MacBook right now is like this because I can read it better, but usually that would be like this. And I have this tick, actually, myself. My wife is making fun of that, you know, I have a packed desk, but it's all...
Organized
in line, and I know exactly where this is. Yeah. And so I was smiling at, I am smiling at stuff like that when you see characters having these kinds of traits, and then I'm thinking, like, does this make it more fun? Like we just established.
It's loads of fun. And also the books are, we have so much given to us because Mick has written book after book. So I'm reading book 5 at the moment, for instance, just for fun. And there'll be details about Catherine in there. I go, oh, yeah, I've forgotten about that. Or, oh, that's a good one. Or I'll be reading a book about somebody else. I was reading a wonderful book earlier in the year about an alcoholic. And she's so articulate about her drinking and her journey to sobriety. And I was like, that is beautifully put. You know, so I'll take that and I'll put it in my bag of Catherine stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. For instance.
Let's stay a bit on set. What I love is a good corpsing story. Do you have any? Because
it was a very dry experience filming this. There was no corpsing.
We filmed,
we did our job, we went home.
No way.
No, he's joking.
I don't think I corpsed once, though.
No, I didn't.
Sorry to give you a
boring
answer.
Catherine doesn't smile very much, so I can't allow myself to do that.
No, I've got no excuse because my character's a bit lighter, but I just... and I've got a comedy background, but I just didn't.
Yeah. But I think that the more quiet ones on a set, that maybe they are prone to corpse more than, you know, like a loud character, you know, if you... You know, you got a Ricky Gervais on set, and then you know he's going to corpse, okay? But it's too obvious. But I'm, you know, when I see the scenes where, you know, where the Slough houses together, you know, and I'm seeing this scene, and I'm thinking, this feels like a real moment. This is not scripted. This is not acted. This is happening right now. And I hope I get my point across, is that I sit there and I would react as a normal person to a sentence like that with corpsing or laughing my ass off. But you have to.
I remember thinking that when we had the read through, I remember asking the director, what's our sort of general reaction to Lamb's put downs? And I said, because in real life, I think I'd find them quite funny. And I just remember thinking, I don't want to always sort of have to roll my eyes and sort of like, you know, sort of hunch my shoulders and sort of walk out dejected every time he makes he puts you down. Because in real life, I think you can always see the funny side and the light and shade. And I was like, what is the tone? Because I wonder if now and again, is there not a smirk and a kind of eye roll like that? We're quite enjoying it, especially if you're not on the receiving end of it.
Yeah.
You're going to enjoy him, you know, tearing, you know, River a new one sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think those scenes where we're all together, they're rare. There's a few of them, but they were very fun because it did feel like sort of group of school children and getting told off by the headmaster.
Yeah.
And those moments when you're not allowed to laugh are always best. Where it hurts.
Yeah. So was there room for improv?
Yeah. I mean, no and yes. Gary, I really think Gary set the tone for all that because he's a master of making you feel like he's just doing it in the moment.
Mm.
And he's also got funny bones. So and he has this truth thermometer. He just knows himself. He knows how to make something believable.
Mm.
So he'll use the set, the world he's in. He won't go off script, but he'll make it feel like he can physically inhabit, do anything. And that was very, for me, very releasing.
Mm.
So I started inventing stuff and doing little details that weren't necessarily, you realize that, I don't have to just do that and that as in the script. I can do loads of other stuff in between.
Mm.
Yeah, I never felt like I was rooted to the spot. You got to hit your mark maybe, but there was a lot of freedom. You could sort of, in the rehearsal and then the first few takes, you could make a few choices and not have to stick to them. You weren't like, now I've got to scratch my nose every time on that beat. You know, it was very, it did feel loose. And you're right, Gary does set that tone of like, even if it's not necessarily literally improvised, you're not going off script, it feels very spontaneous and truthful.
Yeah, yeah. But I think going back to the humour and the corpsing, I think there's an element to this series in one and two, which is their Englishness and their irony.
Mm.
And we don't have the same sense of humour as Germans. Nobody cracks a smile, but they say a lot of funny things. It's almost like a challenge. So I'm going to say something funnier than what you've just said, or even more insulting, and I'm not going to laugh either.
Mm.
So there is a banter in that, which is a very British way of being funny and not laughing. And also a lot of his insults, you don't quite know where he's going with them. Or maybe I'm just speaking for my character, but you're not quite sure where he's going. So you have to be on your guard, as well as bat it back or, you know.
Yeah.
And then also maybe some of them don't always land that well as well, which is kind of true because, you know, not everything you say is so crisp and perfect and, you know, perfectly scripted sometimes. Even your put down might sort of not quite land.
Yeah. The thing is that I've grown up with British comedy, I'd say, you know, across the board. We had Mr. Bean here, but we also had... I'm sorry.
I was waiting for either Benny Hill or Mr. Bean.
That's actually the next thing I was going to say, because Tommy we had Cooper. Benny Hill, but when you see like Monty Python, you know, which I loved more than anything else.
Monty Python.
Even as a kid, you know. Of course, I could laugh at the naked ladies at the Benny Hill show. Try to produce that now. A Benny Hill show.
No.
Well, even Fawlty Towers, which I think
is
masterful.
Yeah.
It's Absolutely. Very difficult to watch some of those episodes now.
Yeah.
Mm.
But we love that. And I love I love
because they're not PC is what I mean.
Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing that you couldn't go there these days.
It's very fast-moving taste in comedy. Like,
yeah.
I think 5 years is sort of quite a telling period of time where you look at, you know, TV shows...
Mm.
5 years old, 60, 70, they date very quickly. It's like music comedy.
Tommy Cooper, though.
Well, good. I guess maybe good comedy doesn't date. You know, it's always it dates, but it can sort of, it's a very tricky one.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up Cardinal Burns way later in the interview, but you know,
Cardinal Burns.
That's my comedy.
Cardinal Burns.
My comedy double act that I...
that you have.
Just to fill you in, Saskia, I used to have my own show on TV. So I'm not, I didn't land from planet Gorm. Gormless. Land from planet Gormless. What about it?
Wanted to ask if the background in comedy is helpful for things like this, where you have the combination of dark, like really dark humor and dark drama, and then, you know, which is...
I don't know. Maybe if you've got a background in comedy, certainly writing, you've got a skill that you can maybe tweak a line, maybe sort of see a bit of an absurd scenario play out. I don't know. But then usually it's not required. You're not really asked to turn up there and sort of give your, you know, comedy.
Yeah.
I think usually good comedy, and certainly what I try and do is like, again, it's truth. It's like you're not playing something for comedy, really, or at least the best comedy, I think.
Yeah.
And why this works is because it's believable. It's a real life situation, and it's the sort of comedy juxtaposed with like the sort of the failure of them all and the reality of their situation. So you're not trying to play that really and be art. You're just playing the moment truthfully. Mm. Whereas Cardinal Burns was a very surreal, silly sketch show. Which we would completely go overboard with, and characters were big and extreme. Very silly a lot of the time. But it was always like silly. It was either a silly, you'd either have a silly, silly character in a very normal situation.
Exactly, because...
So the direct opposite of that, which would be...
A very serious character.
A very serious character in a ridiculous situation. Mm. That was sort of like that always seemed to be our... Yeah. So there's always... So one of those is always truthful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. When I was jumping up and down when Martin and I set up this interview, and my wife was just like, who are you interviewing? And I was saying, it was Saskia Reeves. And Dustin, and she was like, okay, I know Saskia.
Yeah, exactly. Who?
I'm like, okay, I'll show you something. And I showed her Ooh Cake.
Oh, wow.
I showed her Ooh Cake because that's like such a moment where what you just described, you know, you have a normal situation that goes...
So Saskia... Bonkers. And the listeners. Ooh Cake is a sketch where anyone who's been in that office situation where someone just produces a cake and then you just get a chorus of, ooh, cake, ooh. And everyone, and this is relates to, very, very good, you're good at this. It relates to Slow Horses because it's office-based, very mundane.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just any break in the day or the monotony is so welcome.
Yeah, yeah.
So like anything that slightly alters the, you know, it's a bit of cake. All the office staff will jump up, get their plates, and it'll just, oh, cake, whose birthday is it? Oh, I didn't know it was your birthday. Oh, it becomes this sort of cacophony of like, kind of like birds all sort of pecking and like, and then the cake slowly just gets, well, very quickly gets devoured. But our spin on it was everyone goes back and it lasts 2 minutes, then it's just back to your desk, cake. And then just everyone's got their empty plates or half-eaten cake. And then an hour later, people start getting nosebleeds, people start going mad. And then it becomes this sort of horror film where people, like, and everyone gets sort of tortured.
Like really
tortured through office...
Office supplies.
So like someone's staple gun to the ceiling. Someone's got been drowned in the water cooler. Someone's got... like a fire hose up their bum.
Eyes gouged out with the...
Someone's had their eyes gouged out with drawing pins. And it just becomes...
Like really?
So again, it's that. It's very normal, mundane. And that's, I guess, not to make it all about me and my comedy show. Slow Horses is kind of that marriage of really mundane, awful kind of, what's the word, drudgery? Of like just working in an office, which so many people can relate to. Not that all office jobs are awful, but you know.
Yeah,
it's just sort of doing the same thing and sort of sometimes feeling that what you're doing is to no end and to no point, like rivers rifling through bins all day just for nothing. But then that mixed with suddenly these bursts of high octane, like, you know, life-changing, life-altering, you know, action sequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you have...
Making a difference and your job counting suddenly.
Everybody can, you know, relate to a boss that you hate, that hates your guts and then someone's brains get, you know, blown
yeah
out. You know, this is what I like about the absurdity, and this is why I like Monty Python, when you have a moment and situation, and you maybe you remember the episode where any sketch was happening and in the sketch, if someone was on the phone, they would stop and say, I'm a nine. And would just, you know, some, but throughout, you know, the whole episode. Do you think that only the British, as, you know, somehow being the inventors of spy thrillers, could turn the spy thriller on its head, like you did with this, because you did too?
I think we did it, Mick does it very well, and we're good at it, because maybe the type of humour we've got, and the, it's very sort of, I've seen spies, the spy genre, you know, hit the silly wall very quickly, like Austin Powers. But this is kind of, doing this sort of office-based, sort of like, you know, mundane, like almost like Ricky Gervais's The Office meets sort of really low-key, real, believable. I think it is a British thing that we've done well, humour-wise.
Did you hear about the complete rip-off from The Office in Germany? Because it wasn't an official one. They just did it.
Oh, really? They didn't.
And
kind
through
of...
like the first, because I saw the German version first, and then I went to Australia back then. You know, I don't know, 2000, whatever it was. And my friend's like, "Oh, you have to watch The Office," and I'm like, "Yeah, I heard about that. They won a Golden Globe, right?" And he says, "Yeah." So I'm watching the first episode, and I was like, "Wait a minute! This is a German show. This is the ripper from a German show." It was the other way around. And through the first 3-4 episodes, there was nothing, this is based on, or blah, 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 by the way, blah, blah, blah.
That's risky.
And after fourth episode or something, someone, you know, told the BBC, was like, "Oh, maybe you want to take a look at this." And then supposedly there was a phone call where the BBC said, "You can have this, we give you this, but... you have to
cost this much
knowledge."
Oh, well, you have to at least.
And so it actually said, based on characters created by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant.
Well, that was generous of them.
Yeah, I thought so too, because they could have said, you know, snipers.
They could have charged him so much
could
money.
Could have charged him a lot of money.
Yeah.
Or sued them.
Made another one.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Why did I talk about that?
Office meets Le Carré, as Rosalind says.
So do you think that a boss like Jackson maybe brings you, well, it happens in the show-ish, brings you to a point where you said, I will do better because I have to prove this asshole wrong and show him that I am better than this, or like he's talking about me.
My relationship to Jackson, or Catherine's relationship to Jackson, is very different to everybody else's, because I'm a secretary, even though I think Catherine is a better spy than anybody. Mm. Mm. That's a lot of the fun I'm having with her. I don't know. What do you think Harper's?
I think he
journey.
His journey. I think he.
There it is.
It's tricky with me. Sometimes I kind of feel like he just sort of accepts his lot a bit too easily, and then he does show moments of, you know, what's the word? Heroism.
Yeah, but
you know, he go on.
I was going to say, actually, they're all covering up a lot of stress and misery. So, you know, underneath Min's story, you've got this family life. You've got this tense relationship with his ex-wife, his kids. You've got, you know, trying a new relationship. You've got so much going on underneath. With Catherine, you've got her day-to-day trying to stay sober. You've got, you know, trauma, a lot of trauma in there, being bullied, how I deal with that, you know, what am I doing here? There's a lot of... the reason they're there is because what's going on underneath, actually. They're all having to accept...
It's not just that one sort of mistake. That's the pinnacle.
They all have issues. And I think that's what makes them so satisfying to watch in another series, and hopefully another one and another one. Because we get to dig down and find out about these people a bit more.
Yeah. Fairly early on, I thought that your character might be the best spy of them all. That's fairly early on. That's what I thought. This is very generic, and I hate to ask that, but I just have to. Because you know, after the first episode, I wanted to, you know, fly over there and hug the casting director, because this is such a, it's the perfect ensemble. Of course, we can sit down and just, you know, devour it and just be like, oh, this is nice. But some people have to come up with this, have to decide who's in there and who's, you know, who's part of that ensemble, which is perfect. And I love it. So the generic question is, how is working with such a great ensemble, with people like Gary and Chris? I don't know how many times you've worked with Kristen, but, you know, with these people, Jonathan Pryce and, you know, all that, and you guys and everybody else, this is...
Well, it's been, for me, it's been amazingly positive, delightful. I love it. I love working with Gary. I've only had one scene with Kristen. I wish I had another one. Partly because they're two such very different women. So it's fun. That's fun to get dressed up in her costume and stand in front of Kristen in her costume and let's pretend to be these very different people. Mm. And Jonathan, I said this morning actually, I did a big scene with him which was cut up and put into flashback. I think for this series.
Is there?
No, I think it's the first one, actually.
I think it is the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was with James.
Yeah.
And he was so brilliant. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to do any acting. I just knew what I had to do. And he played, if you're going to talk, he played his objective. I played, it was just total heaven.
Mm.
Mm. And I remember going home going, oh, that's why he's so good.
That's why you're all so good.
He's so famous.
But then I see it as like all of you. For me, it's like I just stepped into a very good club. Mm. And everyone's just, you know, Saskia, Gary, Jonathan, Kristen. Unfortunately, I don't have enough scenes with all of them individually or like many one-on-ones with you. I'm quite sort of siphoned off. But luckily, I've got Rosalind and it's kind of like... That's its whole nice journey on its own, and she's great. And we get, because we spend so much time together in our journey, and we develop as a, you know, our relationship develops. That's a bonus to that. But I must admit, I wish I'd had more to do with, you know, Gary and Saskia, and because you're sort of, you've watched them, and it's part. I mean, I've started in comedy, but I'm getting, you know, drawn into drama and watching these people over the years just sort of just do brilliant things, and it's just like it's really. Amazing.
I mean,
amazing.
They're hard hitters. Everyone is at the top of their game. That was the other thing. So you, I mean, I don't know if you've had this experience, but in the past, you'll be on set with an actor and you go, oh, they don't know their lines well.
Mm.
Oh, God.
Probably makes what people think of me.
No. And you just think, oh, dear. I find myself being very pissed off when that happens.
Well, no, fair enough. Like,
and it's like, it's that is basically part of the baseline of why you're here, why you're being paid.
Your one job, yeah.
And on this, it doesn't even come into the equation. You're on a whole different level of work. You're already up there, prepared on, you know, and that's very exciting.
I definitely haven't been as nervous stepping into something as doing this, apart from maybe when I really, really started out right at the beginning, like literally my first telly job. Like, I didn't know what the camera was, but this was quite terrifying. I was very quickly put at ease though, because it was like, oh, and there's no real egos here, at least they're very well hidden, and it's just like, this is great, and this is professional, and this is like, oh,
that's a better way of describing
it's very this is easy, actually, or it seems easier than, and it's because you're lifted by all the people you want to work with. You don't want to be the best person in the room ever, do you? I rarely think I have been, but like, I think it's, you know, it's not about not being in your getting out of your comfort zone. It's just, you don't want to be, you know, sort of wincing at the other person's performance, thinking, oh, I don't believe you. That takes you out of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well I think it's with any job that you want.
Exactly.
You want to have, you know, colleagues that, you know.
Someone's not done the filing properly.
You want people that know their shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and to pick up on your French. Certain scenes pissed me off because I'm thinking I'm sitting there, and this is I think this is very German, because I'm thinking, why do German actors on TV shows especially struggle to portray or perform a scene that feels as real as you guys do?
Oh,
because like I said before, it's not written dialogue to me. It's not something that is performed. It's someone put up a camera somewhere and there's some guys sitting in a room and, you know, talking to each other. With German television, and I'm sorry to slack them off, but you know, they're not here.
A lot of that's the writing, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say. Yes, and sir. Also the prep time. Sorry to interrupt you, but also television. We are in such a fortunate position doing Slow Horses because we have artists of such quality as Gary Oldman and Kristin Scott Thomas, who are cinema actors and theatre actors. I've seen both of them on stage. I've seen them in amazing movies.
Sorry to interrupt you. I'm doing it anyway.
I'm going to interrupt you both.
There you go. But it's not, I'm not especially talking about scenes with them. You know, it's
I'm talking about the level of writing, from Dustin said. And actually, this isn't really television, is what my point was.
Okay, sorry.
So if I would say, would you say the same about German actors in film, in German films? I don't think you would.
Mostly.
Oh,
mostly,
really?
Mostly with, you know, this is what I wanted to say.
It's hard we miss the nuance because of the language.
It's nicht schlimm. It's nicht schlimm. Don't worry about it. The thing is that most of the time I'm sitting and watching a German TV show or a German movie and I'm thinking, wow, this is so good. Well acted. This is a brilliant performance, but I'm acknowledging a performance.
Okay.
You see what I mean? Yeah. Is that, and with British or you know, even American television sometimes, you have scenes that just happen. It's just things that happen. And I discover myself just, you know, afterwards, even just thinking.
Interesting.
Oh, there was a camera. That was a TV show. A bit exaggerated, but this.
I mean, I think it is the script, and I think it's the depth of time that they've worked on these scripts, and the fact that there are books to back this up. There's a lot of work has gone into this.
Yeah, the characters are so sort of real and drawn out that that does help. That depth does sort of allow you to not think this is a performance, I'm just watching someone real, because they've just got layers and layers of history, like a real person. It's not just this one-dimensional character on telly. I think you're sort of talking about, it's more like the rhythms and the just literally like the sort of, I don't know, the way you're talking about these German actors, very broad, but like just being, it's a performance, which is strange. But they're going to hate you now.
Most of them do.
Do you think it's just a different taste?
Maybe.
The style, the taste, the I mean, like.
But even it's in another language, you know.
When I watch French stuff, I'm half French, and actually, I was really excited about meeting Kristin because of her all her French work. I really enjoy, you know, when you get often the film subjects are very just bourgeois, like, you know, this is just middle class life in Paris or something, like having an affair. But in terms of performance and the acting, it is like you say, you just sort of feel like you're just sort of a fly on the wall. And it's very satisfying sometimes to watch. But anyway, sorry. Okay,
Do you remember Eurotrash?
Yeah, of course.
And I love that because you got to really see how, Germans like those sort of jokes, French like those sort of jokes, you know. And I think there is a sort of an unspecified way that different countries laugh at different things. So maybe you're just too continental.
I'm a breakfast. I think basically I'm...
You're a croissant.
What are you?
Basically, I'm trying to pay a compliment in saying this is fucking a job. So there you go.
Thank you.
No, and we're not biting back, and we're defending German actors. No, but
yeah, why would you? What's up with that? don't do that. No. It's all good. It's fine.
No, it's very flattering.
I think we've established something there that, you know, because it's my perception of things that are happening, and I think, you know, a German actor. I know these guys, or I met these guys, and I'm even if they're doing something amazing. I have a friend. One of my best friends, one of my oldest friends, is the German voice of Leonardo DiCaprio.
Wow.
So I know Leonardo DiCaprio's work, you know, and, you know, he's a good actor.
He's all right.
And I also know my friend, which is a very good voice and dubbing actor. Very good one. And here's what always happens. I see him in a new movie or TV show. He's also Sheldon Cooper on The Big Bang Theory. It's the same guy in Germany. So I always see him or hear him, and for the first 2 minutes it's him, It's like, oh, Gerrit has done another job. Oh, blah, 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 blah. And then he vanishes. And then he's gone in my head. It's not, you know, he's doing his job and there's the performance. And I'm not thinking about, this guy pretending to be that guy or that person. And with good actors all around the world, the same thing happens. If you see Tom Hanks, for the first 2 minutes, you're thinking, well, there goes Forrest again. What's he up to now? And then he vanishes into the character. Mm-hmm. And with certain things on television throughout the last years and a show like Slow Horses, there wasn't a second where I thought, oh, there's good old Gary or whoever standing there and giving a brilliant performance. That's my point. It's there. It's right there from the very first.
He's the character.
Everybody is. I'm just.
Yeah, everybody.
Everybody is. And that's
Gary in particular. I think what I was so excited about is, as a, you know, I suppose it's always this kind of, I'm a character actor, I want to be a character actor. It's like, well, that's what most actors are really,
yeah,
isn't
exactly.
it? But he is the chameleon aspect of it. It is quite satisfying when you watch actors who are just comfortable to not have to look great. Not, you know, they're not, I guess that's the difference between like a star or like an actor, isn't it? Mm. But Gary is someone whose career, if you look at like, I don't know his theatre work like you do, but certainly like early Mike Lee and like, you know, Meantime and like Sid and Nancy through to quite big, fun performances in Leon through to like winning the Oscar for Churchill. You just think, wow, that's quite an arc. And that's, but that's always changing it up and always sort of not relying on your... what we know of you as Gary, because we're not quite sure. It's always in there, though, isn't it? Like when you're watching there's a light of...
He's very funny, Gary.
He is funny, yeah. He's very funny.
And he's also got an amazing ear. So his left ear is much nicer. No, he's... So in the first series, I remember we were talking about corpsing, but we were on set and... we were actually on location, and he had this app where you could do somebody's voice and it would turn you into that character. So he had Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
He had Robert De Niro.
Like a deep fake thing.
He
had Ray Liotta. Mm-hmm. Oh, that wasn't him. I think that was someone else.
And it was hilarious because he would do these extraordinary voices. His good one at the moment is Peter Falk. So
he is a very good mimic. We were doing that at the screening, the premiere for Series 1. We were sort of stood in the middle of the party doing our best Keith Richards or Mick Jagger. And it's like, oh, this is, and my wife was with me and she was like watching me and him just giggling and being riffing, silly. Yeah, and it, so. She was like, oh, that's, and it was like, yeah, that's what's great. That is really what's great. You're not just sort of like doffing your cap and going, it was such an honour to work with you. You know what I mean?
You really are mucking about.
And
then that fabric just comes into the scene as well.
Mm. Do you want to hear my Mick Jagger?
Absolutely.
He does a good Gary Oldman, actually.
Am I allowed to do it?
Yeah, go on. Gary, here we go.
Okay.
Gary.
You can go for it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, it's very good. Oh, you horrible lumps. What are you doing?
Something like that. It's a London thing.
As if he were in the room.
I know.
He's still got London, considering he's lived in America for a long time. He's still a real Londoner.
It's still there. You guys have been in some of the best things on television ever. You know, it's Luther or Barnaby or something, you know, stuff like that, and which is, you know, has its place. But you...
This is more a question for Saskia.
No. The thing is, the question itself goes to both of you, but you've been... part of one of the best things throughout the last 20 or 25 years or whatever.
Go on.
Because you've been part of Dark Crystal Age.
Hey.
Yeah?
Dark Crystal.
Yeah, like 3 or 5 minutes.
Okay, good. 3 or 5 minutes, okay.
Dark Crystal.
Dark Crystal Age of Resistance.
Yeah.
And you've been a part of that. And it pisses me off because...
Did you like the reinterpretation of it or whatever you call it?
No, I loved it. It was absolutely amazing. The whole thing was amazing. But it reminded me of my biggest regret. This is where my question is heading. Because as a kid in 1981, 1982, when I saw the making of the Dark Crystal, the original one, that was the moment when I decided, whatever it is, whatever it's going to be, I'm going to do something in movies, in film. And I just watched that all over and over and over again.
That was the film.
That was the film, and you were part of that series, and that reminded me, and that's just my funny way of bringing the question up, because the thing is that when I grew older, that was always a part of me that wanted to be a Muppeteer. I wanted to work with Hansen in the workshop or wherever I would end up. And there actually was, a couple of years later, there was like this open casting call that they put out in Germany where they said, do you think you have it in you to be a Muppeteer? Come to London. And I never did.
For Avenue Q, was it?
I'm not sure what it was. No. It was early 90s something.
Uh-huh. Well, here's the thing. I got my equity card years ago because I became a member of the Covent Garden Theatre Company, and it was a puppet theatre company. And we worked with two guys who worked with Luck and Floor. You do remember the satirical programme, which we don't have anymore, which we should, where they turned all the politicians...
Spitting Image?
That's it.
Oh, right, yeah.
So Luck and Floor did all those puppets, and we had two guys who'd worked with them.
Yeah.
And we did two shows where... We had the most amazing puppets. I was Margaret Thatcher at one point. I was also the Thought Police, which was three Margaret Thatchers in one little box on my head, and things like that. So, yeah, puppet work.
That sounds fun.
Very interesting.
Absolutely. No, but I didn't go because I was too lazy or too scared or whatever. And this is something, if people ask me, what's your biggest regret? Still, to this day, I've met... people from Hansen. I met one of the original Kermits that took over after Jim Hansen died. And I almost couldn't get through the interview. And I told him that story and he said, this is one of my biggest regret. And was I crazy not to go? And he said, this actually might have been, that was an idiotic thing to do or not to do. So my question was, or would have been, do you have that?
Any regret?
Like a regret. To end on a damn.
On a jolly note.
on a jolly note.
I know, yeah.
Well, I have many regrets, but I don't want to think of them as regrets.
Yeah, okay.
Because I don't like that burden on myself, and I think it's very hard on myself, so I don't do it. Okay. I just say I made different choices. And everyone has... I also don't try and compare myself. So if I'm going off in a direction... I just keep going in wherever that takes me, whatever choices I made or make. Because I think I don't know, it's a very interesting question because it's something I would avoid thinking about.
As an actor as well, I think you're always comparing, or at least it's hard not to. Trajectory, your career, why didn't I get that role? Why am I not doing that? And it is hard, but I think that is really important not to look over, grass is greener, why am I not doing that? Stay in your lane.
I should have done that.
I've got so many jobs where I'm like, I wish I'd done that, I wish I'd said yes, or I wish I hadn't said no.
This is quite juicy, isn't it, when you hear about really famous films like Gone with the Wind or...
Different cast.
Yeah, so-and-so turned that down, or Paul Newman decided not to do that.
And you can't imagine... It's like Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future. Imagine it not being Michael J. Fox. That's the one that always gets me.
Maybe I'm just looking for people that tell me... You want a heavy story. Maybe I'm just looking for people to tell me, get over it, move on.
You're being very hard on yourself.
I am.
You said you were lazy. You're not lazy.
Well...
You run the world's biggest podcast.
I am. You were. And so to let you go with my famous, you don't know it, but my famous last question, and that's it. Then on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most optimistic, how do you see the future of mankind and why?
Oh, God.
Thank you very much.
That's it. Great.
No.
Oh, that's his question.
I thought the question is so ridiculous, we don't have to answer it.
Exactly. Christ. That's the trick.
Like Elon Musk, I'm optimistic. But it's a few steps back before we go forward. I don't know. I kind of feel like, I've just been watching a documentary about Elon Musk, so he's very in my head. But it would be nice to spend a bit more time and resources and put these brilliant minds to slowing down global warming and everything before we maybe send us all to space. A bit of a balance
there.
I
agree with that.
you know, let's not just all fuck off quite yet. Let's try and mend it. But I'm optimistic. I'm sure we can reverse some stuff, but that just sort of makes me feel better about when I fly.
Okay.
Okay. I think if I was living in 18th, 17th century London, would I still think the same? As life is pretty tough and, you know, oh my God, we're all doomed. I mean, for instance, knife crime really worries me in London and upsets me.
But then how dangerous would it have been if you were a 16-year-old in the streets of Victorian London?
Having said that, climate change is massively worrying.
Yeah.
But, I don't know.
But we're not here to talk about that. No, we're here to promote a TV show.
Yeah, and you have. It's okay. So I'm hearing a 7, 8... And I'm hearing a...
Yeah, that sounds all right.
Yeah, as well?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was not too shabby.
Hey. No.
Vielen Dank an Saskia Reeves und Dustin Demery Burns. Und Slow Horses ist die Show und die zweite Staffel ist da und die dritte, die vierte werden auch kommen. Es war einfach fantastisch. Vielen, vielen Dank an Apple und vielen, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Logenplatz, der Filmpodcast mit meiner Einer. Dankeschön. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ich muss los.
Logenplatz, eine Produktion der Podcast 1 GmbH.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.